Thank you, Dick. Hi, everybody. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
My name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been going around the country for a long time telling people not to come up to me after the meeting and say you've been through Lake Providence, because where the hell would you be going? And there's a lot of truth to that, but alcoholics are queer ducks, as you well know, and during the time of the International in New Orleans, we couldn't hardly do anything for people that were stopping by in Lake Providence just to call my bluff on the fact that they they were going through it. And it was real refreshing, and we just thoroughly enjoyed it. We really did. I notice that here you give your last names a lot, and I don't have any objection to that, and I recognize that it's fully acceptable in the fellowship. My name is Tom O'Sullivan. I never say it like that, but I don't have any real reason not to, unless it's something unconscious. My initials are TOS. I was riding along in the car one night when I first got into AA, going to a meeting, and I heard one of these radio commercials about Saratans is nature spelled backwards. And I got to thinking about what my initials spell backwards say, and it almost gave me an inferiority complex. I got to wondering if I was snake bit right from the beginning, but I got over that because I recognized that what I got ain't something you could inherit from your mama and daddy. You got to work at what I ended up being, and heredity alone won't get it. I want to thank you for inviting me here. I'm real glad to be here. Of course, actually, I'm glad to be any place, really. But I don't know whether all 1,560 of you are here, but the thought that that many people would come to a place where they knew I was going to be still overwhelms me. I mean, because that's right. Because at the end of my drinking, I might get invited someplace because of my mama, but nobody ever asked me to come someplace if they had any choice ahead of time, you know? And so I really appreciate this. I really and truly do. And then, of course, another thing, I want to thank each one of you personally for being here, because I come a long ways to be here. And I'd hate like hell to come all this distance and not have anybody show up. So it's it's real nice of each one of you to be here, really and truly. And I'm glad to be here. I heard a guy tell a story one time about two young boys that lived diagonally across the street from a house of ill repute. And in the evenings, they would see these big boys go over there, and they'd knock on the door and pass some money through to the lady, and then go in, and a little while later, they'd come out with a kind of smug look on their faces. And it whetted these guys' curiosity, and they wanted to find out what was going on over there, and so they managed to get a hold of 25 cents each, and they went over there early one evening and knocked on the door, and this lady came to the door and saw them there and said, "What do you young punks want?" And they said, "Well, we want to go find out whatever it is that the big boys are doing that they seem to enjoy so much." Well, she had let them in the door, and they were standing right in front of her facing each other. And they were holding little 25-cent pieces in their hands, and she took their money from them. And then she grabbed them by the collars and just pounded their heads together. She opened the door and threw them out. And they picked themselves up and walked down the street, and about a half block down the way, one of them turned to the other and said, "You know, I don't believe I could have took $5 worth of that." And I took the whole $5 worth, and that's what I want to tell you about. I said that Tom is my name, and I'm an alcoholic, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I usually like to say is that Tom is who I am, and an alcoholic is what I am. And when I got up this morning, who told the what that we wasn't going to drink? And that's the way it's been all day long. But it wasn't always that way. It used to be that the who'd tell the what we wasn't going to drink, and the what'd say who said we ain't. And the who would say I said we ain't, and the what'd say just you wait and see. And then the what'd go out and get drunk, and the who'd have the hangover. And that reminds me of a story. Well, it don't really remind me of the story. I've known about the story all the way along. But it's a story about them three drunk rabbits, and their names was Foot and Foot, Foot and Foot, Foot, Foot. And they were always arguing with each other, especially about the booze. Foot, Foot, Foot would go to Foot, Foot, and he'd say, look, Foot, Foot's been stealing my booze. And Foot would say, look, Foot, Foot, you and Foot, Foot, Foot are going to have to take this out and handle it between yourselves. Don't get me involved in it. And this kind of stuff was going on all the time. And then one day, Foot died. And they give him a good funeral, but you know how it is. You got to get juiced up to go to a funeral. And after it was all over, they were sitting alongside a fence with the ears. You know how a drunk rabbit looks. And Foot, Foot, Foot turned to Foot, Foot, and he said, well, I guess we'll have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous now that we got one foot in the grave. There's a vehicle in the parking lot with the lights on, and it belongs to Joe Francis. Now, Joe, look, I'm just getting started, and I ain't warmed up yet, but for God's sakes, go move that damn car before I get going good. Joe Francis, vehicle in the parking lot with the lights on. I don't really know when I started drinking, but I know why I started drinking. And I started drinking because everybody else was doing it. And you may not think that's a big deal, but I think it's pretty doggone important. I used to say, I don't say it anymore, but I used to say I started drinking for the same reason that a bow-legged gal wears a miniskirt. Now, there's some things that you just know you'd be better off not doing. I ain't saying it's a basic character defect. But I am saying there are many things in life that people know they're better off not doing, but if everybody else is doing, it is hard to stand off on the side and be different, you see? And this is the earliest memory I have. The earliest memories I have are memories of standing off on the side of the group and being odd and peculiar and different. And, you know, today I call it unique, but I didn't know that word back then. And, when it came time for the crowd I ran around with to drink, I didn't want to be called a sissy and a panty waist, and so just to belong, I drank. And I had trouble with my drinking right from the beginning, and I'm not going to waste any time. I'm going to go right ahead and tell you what the trouble was. When I drink, I'd puke. Now, a lot of people don't like me to use that word. They say you ought not to say that. You ought to say you were sick at the stomach. But that wouldn't be telling it exactly like it was, because a lot of times it's true I was sick at the stomach, but a lot of times I wasn't. I mean, a lot of times I'd take a drink or two or three real quick, and I'd feel just as good as I feel right now. And out of a clear blue sky, I'd puke. And anything you do over and over and over, you get good at it. And I got good at puking. I did. I got so I could walk down the street and puke and never miss a step. And never get any on me. And I'll tell you another thing I learned later on is that once you really master a skill, you never lose it. Now, I've got a son that graduated from West Point, and after he got out of West Point, he transferred to the Air Force. And one time he and his wife and infant son came to our house for a visit, and they brought this 24-hour flu bug with them. And everybody in the house got it. And man, with that stuff, You get sick in all directions. It was the first time in my life I had ever been sick sober. And we ain't got but one bathroom at home. And I told my son, I said, you know, I'm ashamed of you. I told him, I said, man, if you ain't no better in the air than you are in the bathroom, the country's in a hell of a shape, you know. But I was just as good as I was 20 years ago. I could be sitting around that round table in our dining room and get up and go do what I had to do neatly and come back and never miss my turn to talk. And it was important for me in those days to learn how to drink successfully, and I did. And successful drinking to me then meant that I could go out and tie on a load and somehow or another get home. And then when the bed passed by, I'd jump in. And then when it started to go round and round and round and round, I'd hang on and pass out without having to get up and go to the bathroom and puke. And that to me was successful drinking. And I didn't keep this up. I come from this dumb hick town of Lake Providence, Louisiana. And I wanted to go off and be a success and a hero. And I'm going to tell you about that in just a minute. And as I say, I didn't keep this first drinking up. But I call this kid punk drinking, really. I mean, and I don't really think that this had anything to do with me becoming an alcoholic except one thing. And this, to me, is tremendously important. And I just have to say it because it's important for me to say it. It emphasizes the fact that if you're going to be an alcoholic, you got to drink. Now, there seems to be some confusion about this in different places in the country. I'll tell you, in a lot of places, it's an in thing to belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. People like everything we got here. They like the warmth and the fellowship and the friendship and the love and the concern and all these good, beautiful things that we got, but they miss out on the part about drinking. And in this day and time, it's not good to be careless of the words you use concerning disadvantaged groups. But there's one disadvantaged group that I only can say that I have pity for. And that are those people who would like to be alcoholics and ain't got what it takes. Now, I know people that'll drink and puke and quit. And, of course, you can't get any place that way. You see, not just everyone can be an alcoholic. In order to be an alcoholic, you have to have certain outstanding characteristics. You have to have courage and fortitude and a determination to envision a goal and let nothing keep you from achieving that goal. And just everybody can't pull it off. And so I have true pity for those people who'd like to be alcoholics and can't do it. But that's what I say why I tell about this early drinking, because it emphasizes what to me is a terrifically important point, and that is that if you are going to be an alcoholic, you've got to drink. And while we're on the subject, it brings up another thing that I think needs to be brought out, because there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding about that. And it's this, that if you're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you've got to quit. Now, there's a world of people don't catch on to that. They like everything we got here. They like the friendship and the fellowship and the warmth and the concern and the love and all these good things that we got, and they miss out on the part about not drinking. I don't think it's entirely their fault. I think sometimes we don't tell them the whole truth when they first get here. Now, look, there's a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't make it up. It was here when I got here. The requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. I think the trouble is that a lot of us don't know what a desire is. A lot of people think that a desire is something that if you got it, it's all right, and if you don't have it, it don't make much difference one way or the other, but that's not so. I didn't know what a desire was, but my wife straightened me out on what a desire is. Now, I'm married to a good-looking woman who's a good cook. You'll have an opportunity to hear from her tomorrow morning. And she's a gal that got me straight on what a desire was. One night we had some people over to the house for a meal before we went to a meeting. And afterwards there was three couples of us in the car going to a meeting, and they kept complimenting her on the meal that she had served. And she said, yeah, that's why Tom married me, because of my cooking. Well, she said that three times, and I couldn't stand it any longer, and I told her, I said, look, I never will forget the first time I saw you walking down that hospital corridor on those high heels, shaking from side to side. And I was an alcoholic right at that stage where booze made me think that I was God's gift to women. And I told her, if you think I married you for your cooking, you're nuts. And I did something that I do a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is I say something and then later on I go home and meditate on this thing that has come out of my mouth. And it dawned on me that no married man at any rate should ever have any doubt about what this requirement for membership is, because it may have been so long ago that you've forgotten about it. But that's what those gals did when we were courting them. You see, they knew by instinct that attraction was better than promotion. And they led us on and led us on and led us on and put a whole lot of ideas in our heads and got us all ready for action. And then one day they drew a line and said, uh-uh. And what they really said, if you ever stop to think about it, was, if you've decided that you want what I got, and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Of course, there's some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier south of way. You see, that's a desire. A desire is a screaming, meamy itch to get the thing you desire. And you'd do anything in God's green earth to get it. And I'll tell you another thing about a desire. If you're going to have a desire, you got to have some kind of general idea of what it is you're going to desire in the first place. I mean, you can't just go out and sit in the field and desire. But anyway, like I said, I didn't want to stay in this dumb little Hicktown Lake province. I wanted to go off and be a success and a hero. And it never occurred to me that maybe you couldn't take a little dumb hick kid out of that kind of town and put him, say, in a college setup, and maybe he wouldn't feel comfortable. But that's exactly what happened to me. You see, I went off to college, and I got into this college town, and I didn't feel comfortable at all. I mean, I just felt completely out of place. I began to be thrown with people that seemed to know a lot of things that I didn't know. They seemed to have a lot of things that I didn't have. Not just money, although money was included, but they seemed to be just better generally informed people than I was. And I just felt like a fish out of water. I was a hell of a fish out of water with people. And I never will forget one time shortly after I'd gone off to college, and a group of us went out one night for a steak dinner. And we were sitting at a round table, and the waitress came around and was asking everybody what kind of salad dressing they wanted on their salad. And when she got to me, I said, Kraft. And well, you see, y'all are just like the people. I mean, they laughed at me. And right then and there, I began to develop a lifestyle which lasted until long after I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was this. Then whenever I said anything, I had to observe you closely to see how you reacted to it so I could decide how I meant it. And this is the kind of a way I began to live early on, you see, as a young man. And then another thing at college, I had the same problem that President Carter had. I lusted. And when I lust, I get nervous. I mean, then and now, you know. And I've always liked girls. I mean, even today, you know, you give me a choice of boys or girls, I'll take girls every time. I mean, I used to say I got frigid, but somebody pointed out to me that ain't really what I meant, and it wasn't. I mean, it's the last thing in the world I meant. What I meant was I froze up, you see? I mean, I'd get to talking to a member of the opposite sex, and I'd be standing there just consumed with yearning, and I'd be pulling on my finger like this, you know, and looking at the tops of my shoes and mumbling something like, oh, and I, you know, I didn't have no social life at all. I mean, and somewhere along the line here, as a young man at college, I began to drink again, and a tremendous thing happened to me. And I don't know how to explain this. I don't know whether I drank differently, whether I had grown physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, whatever. But this time when I drank, I didn't get sick as much as I used to. And there even came a time when I didn't get sick at all. But the beautiful thing was that now, when I took a drink or two or three, a tremendous thing happened. And what happened was that people changed. Normally, when I would look at a group of people, like, say, you, only one of two thoughts would come into my mind. Do you threaten me, or are you such that I can use you? But I never could go out amongst you and be part of you. And here I discovered that with a drink or two or three in me, I could. You changed, and I was able to go out amongst you and genuinely participate in the things that you did. And this is something that I could not do sober. Sober, I was just a dope. But with a drink or two or three in me, by God, I was charming. And it just changed the whole world in a manner that I liked, you see. And so I liked to drink when I was with people, and it wasn't just when I was with people that I liked to drink. I liked to drink on occasion when I was by myself. Now, as I said, my last name is O'Sullivan, you know, and I used to talk to myself in the mirror when I'd had a drink or two. I used to love to take a drink or two or three and look in the mirror and talk to myself, and I'd call myself Sully Baby. And I used to smooth my hair down, and I'd say things like, Sully, baby, you're all right, or Sully, baby, you're going to make it. And you know, things like this, and I like this business of having a drink or two or three and talking to Sully, baby, in the mirror. And then there were other times when I was alone that I liked to drink. When I was in New Orleans going to dental school, I lived in an apartment building, and outside was what in the daytime was a sort of a crummy-looking scene, a couple of streetcar tracks and some scraggly old trees. But at night, with a drink or two or three, it was beautiful. And I used to like to sit by that window and have a drink or two or three and look out at the sheer beauty of the night. And sometimes I'd sit by that window and have a glass of red wine or two or three, and I'd get sweet music on the radio, and I'd cry. And I love to cry. And I don't mean bawl, but I just mean fill up with feeling all the way to here and have real hot, wet tears flow over and flow down my cheeks. And I always did think that there was something beautiful about having a drink or two or three and feeling good and being sad. And it was a good way to live, and I liked it, and I pursued it. And I have said this many, many times, that for me it was just as though I had been walking down the street and turned a corner and couldn't find my way back. Because all of a sudden this beautiful life that I had built up, and I had, when I was in my early 30s, I had arrived at success. I was graduated from dental school. I'd taken an internship, some postgraduate training in addition to that. I was in the regular army. I was married with a beautiful family, overseas on a sensitive diplomatic mission, on the general staff. All these things that the little country hick boy had dreamed about, I had achieved. And people started talking ugly about me. They said I smelled bad. Well, I'll admit, someplace in my drinking career, I quit bathing. Now, I didn't taper off, by God, I just quit. But there's a reason for that. I mean, if you're a drinking man like me, you ain't got time to sit still long, and you ain't got no idea how much time it takes to take a bath. Now, and a lot of times, too, you can get in trouble taking things like a bath, and I had a traumatic experience one time taking a bath. I mean, this gal y'all gonna hear tomorrow, this wife of mine, she is nuts about a hot bath. I don't care what the hell's wrong with you, her first suggestion is, why don't you take a hot bath? I mean, by God, that's her answer to every damn thing, is take a hot bath. Now, I'm going to tell you something about me and the way I work this AA program, too. Now, I didn't come in here on Sunday and start bathing on Monday. I mean, I had to get back into the swim of things gradually. And even now, after all this time, what I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous is that as you grow in the fellowship and in the program, I mean, you eventually have to establish a relative scale of value. And I've got a relative scale of values, and I want to tell you that today I'll take a bath. I mean, don't misunderstand me. But it's way the hell down on my scale of values. I mean, I can think of 20 things I'd rather do than take a good hot bath right off the top of my head like that, you know. But she talked me into taking a good hot bath one day when I was still drinking back there. And then she stole my britches from me, And I got a message for you tough young men, you macho types who think you rule the world and do any damn thing you want. I want to tell you, just for your own benefit, without your britches, you ain't nothing, fella. And that's what she did this night. I mean, she stole my britches, and I was in that damn tub, and it is close to time for the liquor store to close. And I hadn't prayed in a long time, because I didn't know nobody to pray to, but I damn found somebody to pray to real quick that night. I mean, I got out that tub wringing wet and got out on my hands and knees. And I begged her to give me back my britches, and she just gave them back at the last damn minute. I mean, and I threw them things on and run down there to the liquor store and just got in there just as he's closing the door. And I may have been sick, but I wasn't that sick. I mean, I just flat damn quit bathing, you know, and, But that's what these people over there were saying about me. They said I smelled bad. And then another thing they were saying was that they said my hand shook. Well, now, I'll admit, if you got a dentist coming at you with one of them long needles and his hand is steady, it ain't too good. But, of course, if he's weaving at you, that ain't good at all, you see. But the point is, I knew my hands were shaking, and I was working on it. And I had it so that I was in real good shape up to 10 o'clock in the morning. And if you'd have come to me by 10 o'clock in the morning, you'd have got the best treatment in the world. Now, I never did like to get up early in the morning. But like I told you, she's a good cook, and she's one of these people that believes if you're going to be well, you have to eat well. And she wanted me to leave for work with a hearty breakfast under my belt. Well, in those days, I couldn't just sit down and eat. I had to get ready to eat. So as much as I hated to get up early in the morning, I had to get up early enough to get drunk up enough to eat breakfast. And then breakfast would sober me up, and then I had to get drunk up enough to go to work, but not so drunk that I couldn't go to work. And that's work. This is 365 damn days out the year that I knew I had this facing me every night when I finally went to sleep. You see, that's what I'm talking about, that courage and fortitude and determination that it takes to be an alcoholic. But as I say, I could time it so that I had just enough under me that I was in tip-top shape up to 10 o'clock. And just before I would leave to go to work, I used to put a drop of Charlemagne perfume on my tongue. And later on, they had some proceedings against me in the Army, and they asked a major that had an office next door to me how I smell when I came to work in the morning, and he said, well, he smelled like a drunken French whore. I mean, this is like... That's the kind of stuff they were saying about me. And I can remember a lot of times I'd have somebody cut on the inside from here to here, and it'd come time to sew them up, and the clock would strike 10. And I'd have to stuff a lot of cotton in their mouth and go over in the corner and take a drink. And they was narrow-minded. Well, see, y'all are just like the colonel. I mean, I'm going to have to explain it to you just like I had to explain it to him. You see, if I was a jackleg dentist, I'd have let him go with the damn gums flapping in the breeze. But I ain't never been that sort of a fella. I have always been a professional man with the highest ethical and moral standard. And I wouldn't dream of letting anybody leave my office without being properly sewed up. And the only way I could do it was to take a drink. And I was the only dentist within 1,500 miles. And then one time some people told me, said, well, if you're having trouble with your hands shaking, why don't you take a goofball or two? So I did that. One day I took a goofball or two or three. And I went to sleep in a lady's lap. And when I came back to the United States, I knew I was in some kind of trouble, and I went to an Army doctor that was well thought of, and I told him I thought I was an alcoholic. I have no idea where I got that word from. It's the first time I ever remember having heard the word. I was a captain in the dental corps at the time, and he told me, said, I'm glad you came to me. He said, just last week, I cured a major general. So they put me in a hospital and stuck a lot of needles in me and out me and up me. And the cure didn't take. And for a long time, I thought it was because I was just a captain. I did, no kidding. I can remember walking down the street and saying to myself, man, if I was just somebody else, this wouldn't be happening to me. And I didn't understand what was happening to my life. I mean, the way it was falling apart. I remember one time I went in a room where there was four people, and I said I thought it would rain, and they all got up and walked out. It was like I had broke wind. And I got all the help that you got. They said to me, why don't you drink like Bill? Bill is a bald-headed brother-in-law of mine. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 and a half years, and tonight I feel about Bill exactly as I did 25 years ago. I don't ever want to do anything like Bill. And besides, how do you drink like Bill? And then they said, get right with God. Well, I got the same question tonight that I had 25 years ago. And the question is, how do you do it? Now, look, you don't have to pay a lot of attention to what I'm saying up here, because if you disagree with what I'm saying, you got a constitutional right to be wrong. But I'm going to stand here and tell you that I don't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous has got the answer to your problem. And the reason I say that is there's no chapter in the book titled There's an Answer. The title of the chapter is There's a Solution. And that's what we've got here. We've got a time-tested, experience-proved solution, and you have to put you in the solution and come up with your own answer. And I believe many times that this may be the true glory of this fellowship, because I'm convinced that much of the trouble with the whole stupid world that we live in today, not just in the area of alcoholism, but surely to include that, is that every Tom, Dick, and Harry you run into has got the answer to your problem, and they don't even know what your stupid problem is. And what we do have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I repeat, is a time-tested, experience-proved solution. And you have to put you in the solution and come up with your own answer. And then they tried to scare me into not drinking. And I don't believe you can scare an alcoholic into stop drinking. Although God knows people try it all the time. And that there's something built into an alcoholic that, as fearful as he may be, fear alone won't stop him from drinking. I don't think. Never did with me. And that reminds me of a story that I got absolutely no business telling, but I'm going to do that anyway. I mean, it's about a little boy that his mama caught him playing with himself. And she gave him a doomsday lecture. She said, that'll make you go blind. And he said, well, could I keep on doing it just till I have to wear glasses? Now, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous I have looked back on this sober and sane, and I really am not equipped to tell you in what condition I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, nor in what condition I stayed there. But I want to say one thing, because to me, at any rate, it's tremendously important. I came to AA and I stayed here a period of time. I don't know precisely how long it was. It was more than 6 months. It was less than 2 years. And then I left. Now, I didn't leave because I was mad. I didn't leave because I didn't think it would work. I didn't leave because I didn't have time to fool around with it. I don't remember that there was any specific reason why I left. I don't even know that I left. All I know is that one night I walked out the door and didn't come back. But I did come back 5 years later. Now, when I walked out the door, I had everything that I held dear and sacred to me in this life. I still had my job, my wife, the family, the money, the position, the prestige, the power, the cars, all the things that I had worked so desperately to achieve. I still had them the night that I walked out and failed to come back. I came back 5 years later with $1.35. And everything else was gone. I want to say something to you, but I, honest to God, don't know how to say it. I want to say something to the person who's sitting out there saying the thing that I hear so often, but I don't like AA. Who the hell cares whether you like AA or not? It may be the only game in town. And if, just if you are a real alcoholic, you goddamn well better sit out there and learn to like it. And I'm saying that out of 5 years of miserable existence that I went through after I walked out of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And whoever you are out there, you realize that's just a suggestion. I came back to AA 5.5 years later, 5 years later. I lost everything I had. My wife had to leave because of the sheer weight of living with an alcoholic. I had become dangerous to my loved ones and to myself. I had passed into the zombie stage. My life was one continuing round of jails and mental institutions and God knows what else. There's no particular point in boring you with these things. They happened to me. And finally, one time, I came to the end of my rope, you know. I've got a real dramatic story about how I surrendered. And I'm sitting here right, standing here right now, toying with whether to tell it to you or not, you know. But I've got other options that I'd rather talk about, and I think I'll choose the other options tonight. If you want to hear about the surrender bit, you can buy a tape from another talk and listen to it. What it all boils down to as far as my surrender point was concerned is I came to the point where I had no alternatives. And let me just tell you this. When you have no further alternatives, you no longer have a problem. And it's just that damn simple. I mean, I came to the point where I no longer had any alternatives. There was nothing else left to do. And I came to the point where, in my own stupid way, I suspected I'd prayed. I found myself laying on the floor one night. I had fallen out of bed, which was no big deal for me. I was always waking up having fallen out of bed, only this night it was different to this extent. I realized that I had fallen out of bed and that I was on the floor. And I had an overwhelmingly deep thought for me. And the thought was, what's the use of getting back in bed? I had nothing against it, but just what was the use in getting back? I'd fall out again. And all of a sudden, it was as though a light came on, and I saw that this is all my life consisted of, was getting in bed and falling out. That's right, I didn't do anything else but that. I mean, get in bed and fall out. I'd stay in bed different periods of time. I mean, just like I'd stay on the floor different periods of time. I mean, it wasn't all continuous, but that's all the hell it was doing, was getting in bed and falling out. And I suddenly realized it wasn't worth it. And that's when I say I prayed, but I didn't pray in the sense that you understand prayer. I just lay there on the floor, and I was earnestly willing that the direction of my life be changed. And I cared not one whit the direction that the change took. I simply had had enough of life of the type that I was living. You know, this is one of the more glorious things in my life. I got up off that floor that night and I walked around that house and not one single thing had changed. But you see, my life has never been the same since because I had already taken my last drink when I got up off the floor and I didn't know that. And this is one of the things that I noticed about prayer in my life today is it is good for me to go through life making as little noise as I possibly can. Lest I miss out on the things that have already taken place in my life. And I'm too stupid to be aware of them because many, maybe most of the things that I pray for in the sense of praying for things have already taken place before it ever occurs to me to pray for them. And my job is simply to cultivate the awareness of the glorious things that have taken place in my life. Well, as is clear, I was sober before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's what it's all about. What we do in AA is learn how to stay sober, not how to get sober. I mean, there ain't nothing to getting sober. I can tell anybody in the world how to get sober. All you got to do to get sober is to stop drinking. I mean, that's all there is to it. I have people call me up all the time and say, how do you get sober? You stop drinking, that's all. They say, but I can't stop drinking. Well, then that's a different question, you know. That's what that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, and that's what I came here and learned. I came here and learned how to stay sober. Getting sober has never been a problem to me. I used to do it 2, 3, and 4 times a day. I mean, it's... staying sober is my problem. I hope I don't step on anybody's toes because I'm going to tell you how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't come like a lot of people say you have to come. A lot of people say, you know, some of these old-timers, they say when you walk in that door, that's what they say down in my country, then that door back there, you have to tell the truth. Well, I don't buy that at all. I mean, because... how am I going to walk in the door and tell the truth? I mean, I didn't know what the truth was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 43 years old when I came here, and for 43 years, I had been a skilled, dedicated, creative liar. And I had to come here and stay a while to find out what the truth was. And then a little longer to find out whether I wanted to tell it or not. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a phony. How else would you expect me to come? I didn't know any other way to come. And I recommend to people who are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, come on in and be a phony. But for God's sakes, be a phony consistently. But I hear people coming in today, you know, and they say, well, I don't think I need to write an inventory. Well, I don't know whether you need to write an inventory or not, and don't care either. But I did. And I'll tell you why. As I said, I was a creative, dedicated, imaginative liar. And I had things so screwed up in my life that I didn't know which was really which. I'll give you an example of what I mean. During World War II, I was shot down over Vienna, Austria, and I got back to my own outfit. Now, that in itself is a good story. But it wasn't enough for me. When I came back from overseas in World War II, they said the veterans didn't want to talk. Well, I did. And every time I got a chance to talk, I told what had happened to me, but I would add on to it. And the way that story finally ended up was that I got captured by the Germans and I escaped. And I want to tell you how I escaped. Late one afternoon, walking at the end of a column under the pretense of having to relieve myself, I drifted off through a shallow ditch onto a grassy plain out into the woods and relieved myself, and then noticed that the column had gone on, not knowing that I had disappeared, and so I wandered through the woods until I made contact with the Russians. Now, that never happened at all. But as I'm standing here talking to you, I can see just as clearly as I can see any one of you that shallow ditch and that grassy plain and the tree that I picked out. You see, when I told lies, I made up mental pictures to go with my lies. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I literally didn't know the truth from the false. And I had to get it down in black and white to try to straighten it out somehow or another. And as far as that particular thing is concerned, it was so screwed up that I'll tell you what I had to do was, I just memorized the good story, and that's what I used for it. I mean, if you want to hear that after the meeting, I'd be glad to tell it to you. And then I hear people say, well, I don't want to take a fifth step, you know, especially this part about admitting to another human being. Well, that wasn't my experience at all. I mean, I didn't have that kind of experience with the fifth step at all. Let me tell you about how I got into this thing. When I was about 8 years old, I was an altar boy in the Catholic Church, and one Sunday I stole a dollar off the collection plate. Now, I got caught and punished. But I carried this thing with me all my life. And as a regular army man, I literally lived around the world. And in New York, in Paris, or London, or Rome, or Tokyo, or wherever, time after time, just as I was ready to doze off into a peaceful night's sleep, up would pop that buck. And I'd stay there with it all night long, until many times in sheer weariness, I'd take a drink or two in order to try to go to sleep. And I'm not saying that the stolen dollar made me drink. It didn't keep me from drinking, I'll tell you that. And then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I had determined that nobody would ever know about this. And thank God the priest that had caught me was dead. Oh, I'll tell you, when I found out he was dead, I was the happiest person alive. The only other person who knew about it was my mother, and by now she was dead, you see. And I was home free. And I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to be aware of this thing that all of us are aware of in Alcoholics Anonymous. You loose-mouthed people. That's a fact. Some of you people sit around here and tell things to each other that no sane human being would tell their lawyer or their priest. And I saw a lot of that going on, and I made up my mind. I said, I'm going to tell somebody about stealing that book. But there's another thing that a lot of people don't know about Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly outside of it. They see four AA members seated at a table and all of them talking, and they think there's a lot of communication going on, but there's not. There's four monologues taking place. Everybody's just mumbling to keep the gears moving so they can submarine in if anybody takes a breath, you see. And I got took in by that completely. And another thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, it is almost impossible in AA to tell anybody what a rat you are. Man, I used to go home and think about stealing that book, and I'd say, by God, I'm going back there and tell them what a rat I am. And you come back here, and you pick somebody out, and you say, look, I want to tell you what a rat I am. Wait a minute. Let me tell you what a rat I am. And really, you know, I said to myself one night, I said, by God, I'm going back until I'm gray-haired. But I'm going to tell somebody about stealing that damn dollar. And so, you see, I was delighted when I finally made an appointment with a guy who would sit down and shut up. And let me tell him all these things I've been wanting to tell somebody all my damn life. And he did just that. He sat down behind that desk by that potted plant, and he let me tell him all the things that I have been dying to tell somebody all my life. And I was scared pea green because I was afraid he might say, well, we take failures, but you... But of course he didn't do that. He listened to the whole pot of filth. And then he kind of smiled that loving smile, and he said, well, you know we love you, you know. And that was the end of it. That was the end of it. And I got tremendous benefits out of taking that first step. All those benefits that are described in the big book came to me in due course. Well, let me tell you one of the tremendous things that happened to me as a result of taking that fourth and fifth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a story. You see, everybody's got to have a story. This is what life is all about, is having a story to tell. And if you don't believe I'm telling the truth, just listen to anybody talk. And that's what they're trying to say is, they're trying to say, I got a story, let me tell you my story. You see, in all my life, I wanted to have a story. I wanted to have a history. I wanted to have roots that went back someplace. I wanted to tell you how I belong and where I've been and how I got here. I wanted to say to somebody, listen to me. But I never could do it because I was scared pea green. And that's what I come out of that fifth step with, was a story, you see, that I don't have to tell you if I don't want to. But I got it. And I know it. And then I went out and made them amends. And I made them amends just like they said make them, like they told me to make them. Nobody suggested a damn thing to me when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got told to do everything I had to do. Now, with all due respect to Dick, who said he stole something from me last night, if that's what he considered stealing, he ain't much of a thief, because he didn't get the damn thing right in the first place. I mean, what I said was that coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot like learning to swim. Now, by God, you can't learn to swim without getting in the water. Ain't nowhere in the world you can do it. And you can't learn to swim without getting in deep water. Now, you can't learn to swim in 18 inches of water. You can drown in 18 inches of water, just like you can drown in water over your head. But if you're going to learn to swim, you got to learn to swim in water, and in water that's deep enough to learn how to swim. And what I'm talking about is these people say, well, I don't want to get too involved in the program right now, you see. Well, my sponsors saw to it that I got involved. My sponsors pushed me off in deep water right from the beginning. And that's what I was telling Dick coming in from the airport yesterday, was that that's what I think a sponsor is. A sponsor is somebody that pushes you off into deep water over your head and then smiles at you and says, trust me. Trust me, I'll pull you out if you actually begin to drown. But by God, you're gonna learn to swim. And that's what they did to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got very few suggestions. Maybe it was because I was too sick. I mean, I wasn't capable of it. I was a sick cookie when I came to it. I may not be too well now, I mean, but you know, nobody knows the difference now. And I went out and I made them amends. And I made them direct amends. And I ain't one for tampering with the program. We got an old guy down home, and man, he's got 40,000 different ways not to do this program. And one night in the group, I love to contradict anything he says. I mean, that's one of the reasons I go to meetings. I sit there, I mean, just waiting for him to say something, you know. This night he says, well, I never made no direct amends, but I made a lot of indirect amends. I says to him, you must be in BB. He said, BB? What's BB? I said, I don't know, but it sure in hell ain't AA. Because the AA program specifies direct amends, you know? And of course, I had to learn what an amend is. Amend suggests that not only are you willing to admit the wrong you've done to another person, not only do you desire to restore the relationship, but also you wish to replace the disorder that you've caused in the lives of the people that you've harmed. You know, I went to a guy one time when I was first fooling around with this amend business, and I said to him, I'm sorry I owe you that $200. He said, goddamn, I am too, you know. Be careful for mistaking an apology for an amend, you know. And not necessarily the same thing in my book. Maybe one of the saddest things that I see in AA are these people who have difficulty taking the third step. There seem to be so many people in AA who seem to think that you have to know something about God in order to take the third step. This hasn't been my experience at all. You see, I think the only thing that is important in the third step is a decision that you make. Now, I must have made this decision years ago or I wouldn't be here tonight. But in the time since I first made it and tonight, my will has changed, my life has changed, and my understanding of God has changed. And if we were here together a year from tonight, I would have to look back on the interval and tell you that in the meantime, my will had changed, my life had changed, my understanding of God has changed. You see, everything in the third step for my money is a variable that changes with the passage of time, except the decision that I make. Now, I think taking the third step is a lot like getting married. And my wife that you meet tomorrow morning, her name is Zida. And over a quarter of a century ago, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Zida as I understood her. And ain't I glad I didn't wait till I understood her? But you see, I made the commitment based on what I could do at the time that I made it. And in the meantime, in the interval, in the years that have gone by, using this commitment as a base, I have grown in relation to her in what I could only call conscious contact. It's a nearness, an understanding, an awareness that permits me, say, even to be in a darkened room with her and yet be keenly aware of her presence. And this, of course, is the thing that I have done with the third step in Alcoholics Anonymous, is simply to make the decision based on what I was able to do at the time that I was able to do it. And then from that point, using the program as a means to grow in conscious contact, I have arrived at some kind of awareness of the presence of a power greater than myself in my life. And this is the thing that sustains me, and it is the reality by which I live today, this awareness that I exist and have my entire being in the presence of a power greater than I am. That's what it says in the big book in the spiritual appendix 2, that our members discover that they have tapped an inner resource, an unsuspected inner resource, which they eventually come to identify with their own concept of a power greater than themselves. And this is the thing that has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which in due course I have come to identify with my own understanding of a power greater than myself. Well, it's getting late. I'll just tell you about the first guy I ever carried the message to and sponsored at the same time, and then we'll call it quits. This guy was on the prison farm when I first made contact with him. I was about 18 months sober when he first heard me, and later on he said that some of the things I said out there made sense, which is an indication of how sick he was. But after he got off the prison farm, he went and tried to drink is what he first tried to do, and he couldn't, and it terrified him, and he came around to our house. And first he went to my wife and then later to me, and what he asked was if we'd teach him how to stay sober. And of course we said we would. Eddie lived with his father. My town is right on the Mississippi River, and we have a levee which protects us from the river when it's at flood stage. And actually the levee is about 3/4 mile from the bed of the river in its normal state. And in this space between the levee and the river, bums, I guess you'd say, tramps, whatever, set up little tin lean-to shanties over there in this area that my town uses as a garbage dump, really. And Eddie's father lived over in the garbage dump, and that's where Eddie went to live, was with his father in the garbage dump. Now, he'd get up early in the morning and come over to our house, and she'd feed him three good meals during the day. And then in between patients, which was a long time in those days, I'd give him gems of wisdom. And at night, he'd go back to his father's house in the garbage dump. And he did this every day as a matter of routine. Now, actually, I had lost my wife. She had left me and had sued me for divorce. And I had just now got back when all this took place. And it wasn't easy to do. I mean, she didn't just come running back. I had to do a lot of charming to get her back. But she had just come back. And one night, I was sitting over on my side of the house. And I was playing a hi-fi, and she come over and said it was too loud. And I said it wasn't. She said it was. I said it wasn't. We had one of them intellectual conversations, you know. And I said it wasn't. She said it wasn't. And I looked at her, and I said, why don't you get out of here? Go, move, beat it, get out. And she said, what do you mean, get out of here? I said, just get out and get out of my sight. And she said, well, for God's sake, you don't mean to go back to San Antonio, do you? I said, that's exactly what I mean. She said, well, I'm not leaving unless you give me some money. I said, I'll give you $20 a week if you get out. You could tell I'm one of the last big spenders. She said that wasn't enough. I went to 40, not enough. 80, not enough. 160, 320, 640. 1280, not enough. I sat right there, and I let that woman bid me up. to $3,650 a week. if she'd just get the hell out. And she said, that's not enough. And I sure started shaking in my stomach, and my fingers and hands started tingling and trembling. And I got up out that chair, and my voice started to quaking. And I pointed my finger at her, and I said, look her here. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and you're making me nervous. And I said, you know, you ain't supposed to make alcoholics nervous. And not me, because I wouldn't talk that way. But my wife said, bullshit. And I tore out that side door into the side yard, and I tell you, I thought I would pop wide open. And I looked up, and there in the gathering twilight come old Eddie. He'd been back to his father's house in the garbage dump and had forgot one of them gems of wisdom I give him. And he'd come back to find out what it was. And I put him in the car and got him straightened out. And then I went back and got straight with her. And I like to remember that night. Because I believe that that night even God himself was in trouble. Because he needed somebody to send to me. And as he looked over all his vast creation, the only person he could find who would go was a tall, skinny drunk with a scratchy voice that lived in a garbage dump. You see, what we do here is help each other. Let's never forget that. For this is a tremendous gift we possess. First to accept, and then to pass on to those who are yet to come. This blessed, precious gift of sobriety, the great life. Thank you.